This is Cherry Glazer from KCRW in Santa Monica, Los Angeles.
Deb Welch from KPBS in San Diego.
Sarah Wright with the KZYX Local News in Mendocino County.
California Public Radio Day, coming soon to a station near you.
Go to kpbs.org and support your public media station.
Welcome in, San Diego. It's Jade Hindman. On today's show, KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen spoke with Jordan Thomas, an anthropologist who studied wildfires and indigenous fire practices extensively. He's also been on the front lines himself and is now out with a book, When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World. This is KPBS Midday Edition, connecting our communities through conversation. Fire season is well underway in California. The Gifford Fire, currently burning through California's central coast, recently reached megafire status, becoming the largest fire in the state so far this year. It is part of a broader trend of worsening wildfires across the region, including here in San Diego. Earlier this week, KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen spoke with Jordan Thomas. He's an anthropologist who studied wildfires and indigenous fire practices extensively. He's also been on the front lines himself, working with an elite team of wildfire firefighters known as the Los Padres Hotshots. He recounts one intense firefighting season with the Hotshots in his book, When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World, where he also unravels the cultural history around fire. Here's that conversation.
So we're seeing wildfires become bigger, more destructive, deadlier, and I imagine that means firefighting efforts have intensified in response. So what is life like on the front lines for firefighters?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You never really know what you're going to get because, like you said, these are some of the largest wildfires that anyone has ever encountered in California's recorded history. But science is having a really hard time keeping up with predicting what these fires are going to do, like how they're going to spread, how they're going to behave, what they're going to do overnight, what the overall ecological impacts are going to be. But wildland firefighters, their job is to know this stuff that science doesn't even know on a day-to-day basis. And their lives depend upon their ability to do that. So what is it like? It's one of the most difficult, one of the most intense jobs on Earth because you're living on the cutting edge of the climate crisis and beyond the edge of what science knows about the climate crisis.
Can you talk more about the Los Padres Hotshots and how you ended up joining this team?
Yeah, so Hotshots, it's a really cool job title that you get in the Forest Service if you're an elite wildland firefighter. That's an official job title, is a hotshot, which is an attraction on its own. But what the hotshots are, they're like the special forces of wildland firefighters in the United States. There's around 100 crews across the U.S. There's 20 people in each crew. And what they do is they get deployed to the most intense, dangerous sections of some of the largest fires. And they have such an elite status because of their fitness. They're essentially tactical athletes who mountaineer around the edges of these incredibly dangerous fires in some of the most rugged terrain in the United States. But they're also really, really intellectually and cognitively attuned to fire behavior, because while they're mountaineering on the edges of these massive wildfires and triple digit heat, they're also having to pay attention to all of the shifting conditions that can change wildfires behavior. And not only that, but figure out how to either steer the fires away from towns and communities or the parts of the landscape they want to protect, or put them out and contain them. Sometimes they do this with chainsaws, and they're often commanding the Black Hawk helicopters and the airplanes that you see. They're doing that from the ground with radios. But sometimes they also light fires around the edges of the wild ones to use fire to contain the wildfires as well. So there's an incredible amount of physical fitness and incredible amount of knowledge that goes into these communities of people.
I can imagine it's really intense, grueling work, very physical labor. What kind of toll can this work take on a firefighter's body and mind?
When you think about the danger of being a wildland firefighter, people often think of getting burned. And that is really dangerous, but the more common injuries and the more common
dangers that you face are the chronic ones. The toll that the firefighting takes on your lungs, the toll that it takes on your joints, and just the toll that constant smoke exposure, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, the toll that that takes on your body, and the psychological toll that just facing this kind of stress, this is background stress of danger takes over time. And part of that stress comes from the fact that wildland firefighters are often not very well taken care of in the long term. There's some compensation to help you if you get hurt on the job, but there's very little long-term compensation for the chronic health effects of the work. And part of that reason is because the chronic health effects have gotten so much worse as climate change has gotten worse and the firefighting efforts have intensified.
Tell me about the people you worked alongside with. What's the culture like in these elite firefighting forces?
There's not much that binds wildland firefighters and hotshots together culturally, except for maybe a really high tolerance for pain and a really good sense of humor in these types of work. Because you have to be able to push really hard past what you could believe your physical limits are. But there's also no escaping that every day. You get kicked awake before sunrise, you hike for hours out to the fire, you work on the edge of the fire until sunset, you hike back, you sleep on the ground, and you do it again. So you really have to figure out a way to laugh and just have a sense of humor with your community when you're in these settings. So there's that. And within that, it's a typically sort of masculine culture. Most wildland firefighters are men. There's some fantastic books coming out this summer from perspectives from female hotshots as well, such as River Selby's book called Hotshot, A Life on Fire. And I recommend people read that for a perspective that's not from the masculine one as well with wildland fires.
Before you joined the hotshots, you were already studying wildfires extensively. What prompted your interest in researching fire and the culture around it?
You know, there are few groups of people and few professions on Earth where you get such a front row seat, such intimate proximity to the widespread environmental changes happening on Earth. So hotshots have a perspective that really very few people on Earth have access to. And as an anthropologist researching the climate crisis and how people experience it and how people are adapting to it and trying to solve it, this automatically just fascinated me and interested me. It was sort of one of those happy coincidences where I also didn't have a job during that time too. So I was super interested in this stuff, didn't really have any career prospects in California where I just moved to. And so I started talking to the hotshots around the same time as I started talking to the anthropology program at the University of California in Santa Barbara. I started researching wildfires at the same time as I started fighting them. So the two perspectives that I weave throughout my book really stem from that.
You've spoken about joining the hotshots as blurring the boundaries between academia and practice. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, while I was on the crew, I was a hotshot. You can't really be doing any other kind of work because it's so all-consuming. It takes, in a lot of fires, it takes all of your concentration just to stay focused on the fire behavior and to stay conscious because the physical activity is so grueling. But then at the same time, in between fires, while we were traveling to them, I was always reading books, taking notes, trying to think about what was creating these contexts that we were fighting fires in. How had they gotten so big? So with the older people in my crew, the leader of the Los Padres Hotshots is in his 50s. When they started their work, they might have encountered one mega fire in their entire career. But the season while I was a hotshot, we fought four of them. And there was 1 million-acre fire as well, which I don't think had ever been recorded in California's history. So it was this constant kind of back and forth of experiencing things and seeing what things are like on the ground and documenting it and bearing witness to it and talking to people about it. But then also pairing that with analysis and trying to understand, okay, but why? Why? Where did this come from? Where are we at? And where are we going from here?
You did a lot of research into indigenous fire practices. Can you tell me more about the history of fire management in California and how it changed with colonization?
Yeah, so California is one of the most fire-evolved regions on Earth. The vast majority of California's ecosystems depend upon certain kinds of fire to remain healthy. So we talk about whether fire is good or bad, like as a singular thing, which doesn't really make sense because you wouldn't talk about whether precipitation is good or bad. Certain kinds of rain are good, but then floods are often bad, right? And it's the same sort of thing with fire. The different types of ecosystems in California need different kinds of fire to stay healthy. And for over 10,000 years, California's indigenous people realized this, and they gave the landscapes the kinds of fire that they needed so often and so frequently that indigenous burning practices actually became the dominant forms of fire the landscapes encountered. So fire was an essential part of indigenous economies because it allowed them to shape the landscapes in ways that they could use to facilitate certain kinds of plants, to attract certain kinds of animals. So the very first thing that the very first governor of California did when Spain took over in the late 18th century was criminalize indigenous fire practices as a way to criminalize indigenous economies, as a way to conquer and subjugate indigenous people. That was also the very first thing that the American government did when we took over in the middle of the 19th century and it became an American state. We criminalized indigenous burn practices, and the first governor called for the genocide of California's indigenous people. And these two things went together. So by the time the United States Forest Service was founded in 1905 and started a policy of total fire suppression soon after, most fires had already been put out because most fires had been were lit by indigenous people and had been criminalized and taken away alongside the colonialism and genocide that really was the dominant force between colonial governments and California's indigenous people. So there's a real injustice embedded in these fires that we're seeing today that really should be part of the conversation when we're thinking about the solutions.
Hmm. In the book, you really focus on deconstructing this idea of fire as a natural disaster. Can you talk more about that and why you think that is important to interrogate?
Yeah, because so when we talk about fire as a natural disaster, really what we're doing is we're just hiding all of the ways in which the choices that we make as a society and in our politics shape the sorts of fires that we encounter. So fires, the sorts of fires we're seeing today, these mega fires, these destructive fires, these new kinds of fire, they're fundamentally emerged from at the nexus of climate change and land mismanagement. Now, these are both political choices. Climate change is caused by the fossil fuel industry and the people who support it in our politics. That is a choice. And there is no form of land management that will work if we don't get a handle on climate change and stop using fossil fuels. That said, with land management, there's also an enormous amount of power that we have to make our lands more resilient to climate change and to make our lands healthy again by returning the right kinds of fire to California's ecosystems. And what this does is, it requires political will, and it requires funding, and it requires organizing. Especially in California, this is not a small government or big government thing. It takes both, because half of California's land is federal land. So if we want to get any handle on the sorts of fires we're seeing today, it will require massive investment from the federal government and the Forest Service. And that's investment not just in flashy technologies, but in people. People like the hotshots who understand fire and who understand how to put fire on the ground and how to make it behave in the ways that will benefit the ecosystems. And it really the opposite thing is happening with our current administration. While they talk about how we need to manage our land, they're actually cutting funding for the people who know how to manage the land, which is the public servants on our public lands who have the skills and expertise to do the sorts of forest management and prescribed burns that will prevent these sorts of fires from being so destructive.
What do you think is missing from the media coverage around wildfires and firefighting?
Two things are missing from the media coverage. The first one is this: every time this wildfire seasons roll around, there's this false debate that emerges about whether this is climate change or forest mismanagement. And the fact is that it's always both. The impacts of climate change are always shaped by the context that they land in. And we need to stop talking about them apart from each other. We need to be smarter than that and think about solutions in lockstep. We need to cut fossil fuel use while also investing in the communities of people who know how to manage our landscapes the right way. The second one is what we're talking about when we say support our firefighters. You see this in banners hanging all around the state of California every time fire season rolls around. But that's just rhetoric at this point, because a lot of wildland firefighters in the off season don't have healthcare. They don't have support. They don't have psychological support for mental health or anything like this. And so when we talk about what it means to support firefighters, it's what it means to support a lot of other working people in this country, which is they need healthcare. they need a social support network. They need funding. They need compensation. And that doesn't happen by banging pots and pans together. That happens by electing people in our politics who support public servants and want to actually pass legislation to increase their funding and to give them healthcare. So I think sort of cutting through that empty rhetoric and actually having the courage to talk about what does it mean politically to support our firefighters and what does it mean politically to get a handle on these wildfires. I think those are the two things that I wish were addressed more clearly every wildfire season.
You've alluded to this a bit already, but what does it mean to get a handle on the crisis of wildfires in California? And what does it look like from a community organizing perspective?
Yeah, so I was asking that exact same question after I was a hotshot. And I started trying to figure this out. And I went up to Northern California to learn from some people who are working on this. So I drove north up to Lake County, which from a visual perspective, it looked like some form of apocalypse. I think 98% of the national forest up there had burned in the previous couple of years. So you just enter this forest of matchsticks, and then you go down to the lake. And but what I found at the edge of the lake was a group of people organizing a prescribed burn. And the group of people there was one of the most hopeful groups of people I've been around working at the nexus of climate change and wildfires, because the project was being led by a group of Pomo peoples and other indigenous groups in the region, partnered with the U.S. Forest Service, partnered with CAL FIRE, partnered with the Air Quality Board in the area, partnered with all sorts of different people from the region who are all coming together to have conversations about what would it mean to bring the right kinds of fire back so that as this landscape heals, as these new forms of plants and trees and forests reemerge, how can they do so alongside fire? And what that means is forming bridges between communities that have been fractured historically. But what that also means is having a real focused, localized attention on your local ecosystem so that you know how to burn and provide the right kinds of fire in the ways that provide the types of plants that you want. So it's a real locally based and socially based movement that needs centralized funding to succeed at the scale that we're talking about in California, but is fundamentally a place of hope and action and possibility. And we're going to need a whole lot more of that all around the state of California in the years to come.
That was Jordan Thomas, author of the book, When It All Burns, Fighting Fire in a Transformed World, speaking with KPBS Metro reporter Andrew Bowen. You can see Jordan talk more about When It All Burns at the book Catapult in South Park on August 21st. He'll also be at the San Diego Book Festival on August 23rd at the University of San Diego campus. You can find more details on these events at kpbs.org. That's our show for today. I'm your host, Jade Hindman. Thanks for tuning in to Midday Edition. Be sure to have a great day on purpose, everyone.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.